Since the show began almost 2 years ago, A Change of Tune has highlighted some of the best up-and-coming artists out of these West Virginia hills, with podcasty chats ranging from the Sea the Sea to Quiet, New God to Coyotes and Boxes, and beyond. But those interviews have been a bit infrequent. And since West Virginia Day was this month, and with A Change of Tune's second birthday on the horizon, we thought we'd do something special. 30 days, 30 brand new West Virginia music interviews that range from Morgantown alt rockers and Parkersburg singer songwriters to West Virginia music venues and regional artist management and beyond, all of which contribute to the state's wild and wonderful music scene. And today we are chatting with Emay, a singer songwriter and well rounded musician who currently resides in Dry Fork, West Virginia. We say well rounded because her music comes from so many different influences and experiences. As she'll tell you in this chat, she learned music from a lounge pianist at the age of 5, fell in love with rock and metal music in Boston, learned world and dance music while studying at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, and she's now settled into the old-time traditions of West Virginia. Can you introduce yourself and what you do in West Virginia?
Sure. My name is Emay, and I make music in West Virginia. I live up in Dry Fork on a farm called Houseberry Farm. So when I'm not playing music, I help tend the bees and work in the garden here. I also have a group called Steel Town Fire that's based out of Pittsburgh, but, you know, it's still my company. So we do a lot of fire dancing gigs. And I also lead horse trail rides and consult and teach music and just generally do all the things that I like to do with my time.
Now, are you originally from Dry Fork, West Virginia, or are you a transplant out of state?
I am a transplant. I lived in Pittsburgh for 13 years before discovering West Virginia. And I'll have to admit my own ignorance that I didn't spend a whole lot of time in West Virginia when I lived in Pittsburgh. When I finally discovered it and moved down here, it was like, West Virginia is pretty awesome. And so it's a good kept secret, I think, to the rest of the country how awesome it is down here. And I promise not to say that too loud to keep our population together.
No, I totally agree. It's a nice, it's a really well-kept secret. And just you were describing some of the things you do in terms of music and art and, you know, just agriculture and farming. And West Virginia is a great place for all those things, really.
Definitely. I grew up in Massachusetts. Most of my family is from New Hampshire, so it has a really similar vibe to New Hampshire, actually. So when I first started coming down here, not only was it like, great, I can be an artist and a musician and cobble together a life doing the things I love, but it also really just reminds me of home.
Was that a rooster?
That was a rooster. That's a comet. That's our rooster. Yeah, so we have, you know, big farm out here, and that's one of the things I love to do, for sure, is to be around here. And I play a lot in the cities, just across the country. And, you know, I feel like, there he is again. you know, I kind of live in retreat. We have a farm and some property, and, you know, I do the horseback riding thing. And when I go to the city, my vacations are like a dose of culture. So I run around doing 100 million things in a very short amount of time and driving all over the city. And then I come back here to work and live and retreat.
So you said that you're from Pittsburgh, but before that you were from Massachusetts. How did you get into music? Was it in Massachusetts or only after you went to Pittsburgh?
I have loved music for as long as I have memories. I mean, I just have always wanted to be as close to sound as possible, as close to music as possible. So when I was a kid, that meant, you know, any live musician anywhere we went had a sidekick for the night, and I would just glue myself to them. And that's how I got my first piano teacher. She was playing in a lounge, and I just wouldn't leave her side. And at the end, she looked at me and she said, "Do you want to play a song?" And I nodded vigorously. And she said, "Well, do you know any songs?" And kind of looked at her shyly, like, "No." And she taught me Ode to Joy right there on the spot. And my mom asked her if she'd teach me piano lessons, and she did. So, I'm glad that my mom noticed early on that I was into it, because it became a really important part of my life. And when I was quitting piano lessons as a teenager, her best friend said, "You can't let her quit. You know, she loves it. Here, I have a guitar." So she gave me a guitar, and I played. Haven't ever put it down. I mean, maybe to go to sleep, but very rarely.
Did you get into any bands when you were growing up, or were you only a solo singer-songwriter performer?
I've mostly been in bands, and up until recently, I hadn't led a band. But I started playing in a rock band in high school, and we played a lot of covers and started writing original music. Didn't play out very often. It was mostly in the garage kind of thing. But in Pittsburgh, I played with a group called Between Liberties. We were a trio. We were all songwriters. Will, he goes by Wytold. Wytold played the cello, and Jason Guzan played the acoustic guitar. So it was, I guess on the early edge of the Americana scene, and we didn't know it was a thing. We were just three songwriters doing what we did. And so that was probably the most reviewed band. We put out an album and got some press and got some airplay on the radio. So I've been in cover bands. I played in a Turkish music group for a while. I got really into world music.
Ooh.
And I lived in Pittsburgh. There's a cool scene up there for that. So I started playing Middle Eastern drums. People are like, "Well, what does that mean?" And I'm like, "Well, think belly dance music." That's kind of what I did, except I played with a guy who was much more into the folk style of Middle Eastern music. So it was almost classical-ish or traditional folk-ish, except in a different part of the world.
What attracted you to that kind of music?
Well, it's very percussive. I mean, the true story, the longer story, I guess, is when I was a freshman in college in September of 2011, we watched these Twin Towers fall about a month after I went. And Pittsburgh was one of those places that they thought the plane that went down in Pennsylvania was headed for, and it was kind of just a mess. Our school went to Carnegie Mellon. It has some big military ties as far as big projects. And I just, I'm a pretty sensitive person, and I watched the news just get spun out about how awful Middle Eastern folks were and how it was it became a really segregated place. It still is, I guess, in a lot of ways. So one thing that I think music is really powerful for is bridging the gap between people who might otherwise have different philosophies or outlooks on life or languages or religions. Music is kind of something that all cultures have and might be easier to learn than, say, another religion. So. And it's way more fun. The fun part is, we played these drums, just would sit out in the park and play rhythms, and just so kind of meditative, the drums, once you get into it. And I had a friend who was half Egyptian, half British, and he was really into it. He's now a PhD in music in California and still studies this type of music. And so his enthusiasm really caught on for me. And it just went from there. I got into the dance, the belly dance. There's a big scene for that in Pittsburgh as well. Jafira Dance Company is a world-renowned dance group based out of Pittsburgh. And it snowballed. I wound up helping to found a place called Your Inner Vagabond, which was a couple who had traveled around the world, and they wanted to settle in Pittsburgh and open a coffee shop. So they asked me to be their music coordinator, and I really got in depth, kind of just got a glimpse of what the world music scene in Pittsburgh had to offer. So we had a lot more than Middle Eastern music. It was Balkan music and songs from China and South America. It was great. It was a really good experience for me musically.
It sounds like Pittsburgh is really the place for you, between the culture and just the rich ethnicity and sound and in life. So how did you move from there to Dry Fork, West Virginia?
Yeah, well, Pittsburgh is a big part of my past, you know, a big part of my history, and I love it. I mean, while I lived there, I was a big advocate for all the things that Pittsburgh has to offer, and I think now people are starting to catch on that it's an awesome city. But I don't know. You move on, I guess. I found a guy. That's the story, you know. I met a guy, and he said, well, I'll move to Pittsburgh. And I say, well, you know, I can always visit Pittsburgh. My friends aren't going anywhere. My life there isn't going anywhere. I had a job through a radio program called the Saturday Light Brigade, you know, so I programmed live music for a number of years on the radio program. And they let me do that from West Virginia. So I said, well, I'm going to go there. I'd like to keep my job. And they were into it. I did that up until a couple months ago. But West Virginia is neat. You know, people ask, when they don't know anything about West Virginia, they ask me a number of questions. One of, like, you're so urban. How do you survive in a rural setting? And like I told you, it feels like home. I mean, I grew up in a similar area, and I just love being out in the country, out in nature. But West Virginia has such a rich musical tradition. It's really, it feels like a really special place. You know, when I was in Boston, all the music I learned was on the radio or guitar tabs or in books. And then in Pittsburgh, you kind of, I don't know, I wrote my own stuff. In the world music scene, we learned a lot of each other's music. But down here, there's a huge tradition of traditional music, old-time music, you know, songs being played around the campfire. I love live music so much that that's really such a turn-on for me musically, to be in a place where people just bring their instruments out to the party and sit on a porch until 4 or 5 in the morning. And then when I go to bed at 4, they tell me I'm, you know, the early bird. I'm like, oh my God, my head is full of music and I'm swimming. And so I've learned a lot about music since I've been down here, and kind of realized how amateur I felt. So now I'm in a process now of just learning as much as I can about the instrument, about music. I was looking at the Augusta Festival when you called.
Oh, the Augusta Festival down in Davis and Elkins. Yeah. No, that's a great haven for all kinds of musicians from around the country and world to just come in and play old time, Appalachian, really hone their craft. It's a great festival. It's a great place to be.
Yeah. I think after spending a lot of time exploring music from around the world, I've finally started growing into the music from where I'm from. You know, my mom's from Pittsburgh. So, you know, we've got Appalachian roots, and kind of sinking into, like, oh, like this is my folk music. You know, Turkish folk music is wonderful, but this is my country's folk music. It's been awesome.
Now, you said that you you helped with programming for your for the radio show. What was it? The Saturday Night or Saturday Light Brigade? That's, I've never really talked to someone or anyone in this interview series with a sort of radio background. So that's kind of interesting. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? How you got into that organization?
Sure. Well, I got into the Saturday Light Brigade as a musician myself. I was playing on their live show and had gone in the second time I played, and was friends with a lot of the people in the station. It was a small organization, a nonprofit. And I got an email from one of my friends that worked there and said, hey, I'm going to leave. Here's my new email address. And I wrote him back. I said, hey, do you think I could have your job? And he said, well, I'm sure Larry would love to hear from you. So I emailed Larry Berger, the boss. He'd been doing the radio program for 30 years at the time, 35 or so now. And it's a great program. It really was a great introduction to the kind of music that I was explaining really is important to me now, this American roots music. So that's the kind of music that we produce. It's a really old-time radio program. Got me into public radio. Like I said, I grew up kind of on commercial radio. It was a great experience. I did a lot of outreach work in the community as a nonprofit. You know, you do a lot of education, a lot of outreach. So I worked with kids a lot, helping them kind of find their own voice, their ability to speak, to use radio equipment, to tell stories, to, you know, even some songs and songwriting things. But mostly with kids, it was just spoken language.
What would you say is the importance of radio in terms of music and storytelling?
God, I don't know
where to start.
Honestly, you know, radio in Boston, even though I call it commercial radio, it was great. I mean, there was just so many varieties of music. You could flip through the channel and, I mean, there were 30 plus stations of just anything. There's a lot of college radio too, a couple nonprofit stations that had great programming. In Pittsburgh, I also worked with an organization called WYEP.
Of course, yeah.
Out of Pittsburgh.
That's their public radio station where it's a AAA, so they play all music.
Yeah, and it's awesome. I mean, I've heard some of my favorite bands there, and I worked at the desk there for a little while, and, you know, they'd have their in-house concert series, and I'd walk into the other room and watch the live recordings and just get blown away. I mean, I got introduced to Dawes that way. I saw Warren Haynes about 10 feet away playing, Allman Brothers acoustic stuff, and, I mean, just... Radio is the closest thing you can get to live music without leaving your home. And I think live music is just one of those vital parts to human experience. Radio, you know, storytelling is such a big part of human culture, too. The ability to share information with one another. Where would we be without that, you know? So carrying the oral tradition in an age where there's so much you can read or watch a video on, just being able to talk and tell stories and learn to listen. And I think it's super vital.
Sitting at the old homestead, hearing voices in the rain. Asking all these questions, but I've no answers to explain. All the hills have turned to rust now, just like an old metal sign. Like apple cider vinegar turns from homemade wine, and it's the same.
Now, you play under the moniker E. May, and your name, though, your full name is Erica May. Is there a reason why you chose to go with a pseudonym instead of your actual full name?
It's been my nickname since college, and I guess everyone's just always called me E-May. It wasn't until Facebook really took off that people started calling me Erica again, because all of a sudden you need a first and last name, but I guess for so many years people just knew me as E-May that it stuck. I hadn't had a nickname as a kid, so it was kind of cool to get a nickname as an adult.
Do you think there's a difference between E-May and Erica? Like, do you think those are two personalities, or is it just the same person and just different name?
I think about this sometimes where, you know, as a performer, as someone who gets up on stage, you kind of are almost expected to have this alternate personality or something that is, like, larger than yourself. And I think I've wanted that a little bit. And of course, you know, with the fire spinning and with some performance art things I've done in the past, I've had that. But with music, I guess mostly as a solo musician, it's really important to me to be transparent. Like, I'm sharing these songs that are from my soul. They're from my experience, but they're also like my perspective on the world. But I feel like when I get up on stage, I have to be myself. You know, there's no band to hide behind. There's not a lot of stage show antics to hide behind when you're solo. So, you know, and it's easier that way. You don't have to worry, am I in character or whatever? yeah.
Well, as E-May, you have a new release out right now titled Longest Dream. Can you talk a little bit about that release and how it came about?
Sure. It was kind of an accident, a beautiful accident. I was playing a friend of mine's piano in Pittsburgh. She had just gotten this gorgeous Steinway piano kind of gifted to her, and it was being housed in a warehouse. And I didn't believe it, but it is a fact that the largest collection of African artifacts in the world is in Pittsburgh.
That's crazy.
Yeah, in a warehouse in the Strip District. It's not like open to the public or anything. But that's where her piano was. It was like on the fourth floor of this building. So we go and we're playing, and I say, man, I need to get some videographer friends of mine in here. You know, do you mind? She said, no. So a couple of friends came over the next day and shot this video for The Judge and for another song called Skipping Stone that are both on the album. And I hadn't been playing the piano very much, but I just had such a good time playing that, and they had such a good time shooting that they wound up putting together a couple videos from it. I said, well, that's great, except now I need to give you some audio. I've been wanting to check out Seth Maynard's studio down here, Lone Wolf in Elkins, and just got in there, recorded Skipping Stone, the one song, and had such a good time. I mean, he's a great engineer, and one of those things, one of those truly West Virginia things is, like, there might not be a lot of recording studios, but the ones that are around are awesome, you know. The one mechanic in a 30-mile radius of my house is the best mechanic I've ever had in my life. So, Seth is great. I've worked with him on a number of recordings since. But because it was kind of an accident, it was really slow to come about. And I just kept kind of adding little things. I added some cello parts. My friend Weitholz that played in Between Liberties, he now performs in D.C. And he sent over some cello tracks. And I had another friend who plays with the Urban Pioneers, Liz Sloan, put some fiddle on. So it was a very organic thing. It's interesting because the piano songs that I've written, maybe just because I wrote them a while ago, or maybe just the medium that is the piano is different to me, but the songs are pretty melancholy. A lot of them are reflections on our mortality and our connection to one another. And it feels a little more cathartic than expressive, you know, a little bit more about what I was going through at the time than what I normally write, which are maybe more reflections and things that are a little more poetic. Yeah, so it hits me in a special place. It really is, like, to me, about connection with other people and how tied together we are, you know, when we're together and when we separate.
Where did the title, Longest Dream, come from?
It's the last song on the album, and it was kind of the lyric starts the song. This is the longest dream. I wait on the porch for you to wake me. That's a good question. It was fitting, you know, because I had only written a few piano songs over the course of my musical career, and most of them made their way onto this album. I'd say more than half of them. I wasn't sure that it would fit together as a package. And once we recorded all of the songs, and I said, oh my gosh, there's, at least from my perspective, definitely a story here. And so The Longest Dream is kind of a suggestion of this life is kind of a dream. Like, we have a certain amount of years that we're here, and we move through it the way we do. But in the end, it's what we remember. It's the little bits of it that, you know, if we were awake, we'd wake up and say, oh, I remember in my dream I did this, I did that. You know, so what are those little pieces? I guess is kind of what the reason I chose that as the title kind of reflects.
You've talked about some of the instruments used on the record or in the record. You know, obviously it's very piano-centric. There's some classical instruments in there. Of course, you're singing. For anyone who hasn't listened to your music before, how would you describe the genre of music you make, or just generally the music that you make?
I think that's a difficult question for any musician to answer, and I find it to be especially true because I have so many influences that I hear. You know, whether or not anyone else hears it is a different question. I'm inspired by the great songwriters, of course, and mostly, I think, musically by classic rock. So when I say I am a songwriter and multi-instrumentalist or singer-songwriter, people here, okay, she's a chick, she's a singer-songwriter, they're thinking Anita Franco, Dar Williams. and I'm like, you know, all due respect, I don't sound anything like them.
No.
You know, maybe more Tracy Chapman, maybe more, I don't know, I love, like, Joanna Newsom, for example. I like really poetic folks and people with strong voices, Alabama Shakes. My roots are in rock and roll, so there's a little bit of rock. And as I get more into finger picking and kind of this American tradition of music, I'm falling a little bit more into like the folk Joni Mitchell kind of thing. But yeah, as far as the solo stuff, I'm a singer-songwriter. And when you put me in a band, it really depends on the band. I've been in rock bands and have a lot of different projects going on that are just totally different. Everything from literally from this, you know, acoustic trio to something called the Black Yoga Meditation Ensemble, which is doom metal music for yoga.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, so it's different, you know. For me, it really depends on the band I'm in at that moment. If you're going to see me play solo, usually I play out with a guitar. So, you know, you could put me in the chick singer-songwriter category, but that would be a very, I feel, limiting label for what I do.
Something we haven't talked about, you've mentioned earlier in the chat, is that you are a, would you call it a fire arts performer? Fire performer? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it.
I'm trying. So how did you get into that line of musical work?
So the fire dance is separate than music, but it's kind of like the way I live my life. You know, when I moved to West Virginia, this idea was that I could start piecing together the things that I love to do in life in order to make a living, to make my life. So in Pittsburgh, one of my main sources of income was fire dancing, and it's a type of dance that you manipulate flaming torches and other props into dance. And as far as it relates to music, I mean, I was always a coordinator of the soundtracks that we used and occasionally put some of my music into the soundtrack. But, you know, people ask what I do for a living, and if I don't say musician first, I say performing artist. You know, I'm kind of a Renaissance person type artist where I love a little bit of everything. You know, in my spare time, I do ceramics too. It's like I just love being creative and experimenting with different mediums. Fire dance was something that kind of just struck me once. I saw someone doing it and I just fell for it. I said, I will learn to do that one day. And maybe 5 years later, someone said, hey, I'm going to a party. Do you want to come? There's a fire dancer. I said, heck yeah. and went, asked her to teach me, and she taught me for a couple months. And then I just kind of took it from there. I studied with a guy, very internationally renowned, named Nick Woolsey. And, you know, members in our group have studied with some of the best fire spinners in the world. And, yeah, I mean, there's an element of danger to it that's really fun and exciting, of course, but it's also very spiritual in a way, very meditative. You have to really be focused on the moment the same way you do with music or any performance art. If you start letting your mind wander, who knows what's going to come out? Who knows where you're going to hit yourself with this fighting tool? Who knows what wrong note you're going to hit? So in my mind, they're very connected, these, you know, performance-type arts. But from an outsider, yeah, playing guitar and spinning fire around your head look a lot different.
So since moving to West Virginia, what would you say has been the most rewarding thing you've done artistically, whether it's using fire or an instrument or something else entirely different?
I started fronting my own band. I've never really been, I've been a singer for a band, but in between Liberties, even though I sang, I wasn't always writing the lyrics. So the first band I was ever in that was kind of, I'm going to lead this wild horse and write most of the original music, was a band called the Follow Your Bliss Band. And even went so far as to call it Ime and the Follow Your Bliss Band, which
Ooh.
Is like a huge step. As much as I love performing, I feel pretty humble. You know, I feel very much like it's a gift and like it's something that I'm just blessed to have in my life. And so it's always been a little intimidating to be like, hey, come look at me. And, you know, I'm not shy by any means, but I'm not, I've always liked to lift other people up versus just talking about myself all the time. You know, I've always worked behind the scenes in the industry, both in the radio station and working festivals and, you know, just kind of in more of a behind the scenes kind of person until I get on stage. And then I'm like, oh, right, this is home. So I think since I've moved to West Virginia, I started acknowledging that my home artistically is on stage, and specifically on stage singing and playing guitar. So just kind of learning about myself musically. I've never given myself the time and space to do that until I moved down here. There's always a lot of pressure when you live in a big city to run the rat race. And so even though Pittsburgh wasn't a huge city and doesn't have much of a music industry, you're still drawn to like, hey, how many people can I get out to my show, and how often am I playing, and at what clubs, and am I doing this right? Am I doing that right? So I kind of avoided that to help other people kind of maneuver it themselves, and learned a lot along the way. And now I feel like I have the time and space to apply it to my own creative career by doing albums that I'm proud of and playing a little bit broader and playing solo and then playing with bands, you know, fronting my own band, telling other people this is the song we're going to play and this is how it's going to go. It's like a little bit less of the communal feel that I love with music, but eventually you get back there once, you know, all the dictatorship kind of falls away and people know the songs and they're playing it the way you want it. Then it's like, ah, okay, now we're back to this communal thing that I love so much about music.
So I'm just going to go ahead. The elephant in the room is that you are a woman and you happen to play music. So what have your experiences been being a sort of minority in this male-led industry?
It's a great, great question. And it's funny because when I tell people, like, yeah, it's a male-dominated industry, a lot of people that aren't in it go, what do you mean? Like Adele. And I'm like, okay, well, think about it. You go to a local band, or my favorite is going to a festival, looking at whoever I'm with who is, you know, obviously asked me this question. And I say, tell me how many females you see on stage this weekend. And almost invariably, unless they're a lead singer like Grace Potter, I love her. I mean, I think she's just a fire starter. And there's a lot of great female front people. But when it comes to musicians in bands, they're pretty rare. So my experience with it is all over the board. Sometimes I love it, you know, because I kind of am the type of person who likes swimming upstream. You know, I like fighting the good fight and clearing room for the future out of a field that might otherwise be unpassable. And people have done it before. You know, one of the cool things that's happened recently is I got a chance to study with Alanis Morissette. And when I was going in, when I was listening to radio in Boston, you know, talk about a guy party. I mean, like rock radio is a whole bunch of testosterone, you know.
Yep.
And I loved rock, so it was great. I mean, I learned how to sing on Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and Nirvana. That was like my thing back as a kid. And right in the middle of that launched, you know, Alanis Morissette just rocketed onto that scene. And I remember the first time I heard her sing, I was just like, oh my God, she's a woman. She rock harder than any of these guys, you know? And I fell for her. I mean, I was just in love. I still know all the lyrics to every song on Jagged Little Pill. And being able to meet her 20 years later and say, thank you for paving the way in this industry is, I mean, it was a highlight of my musical career so far, because I think it's important to thank the people that are doing what we wanted to do. If it weren't for her, I don't know if I would have done it, you know?
Yeah.
Not sure.
Yeah.
And she now is passing the torch on to folks like Taylor Swift, who are, you know, really, I think, positive lights in an otherwise pretty sexist industry. You know, I'm 31, going on 32 years old. I'm never going to be the 16-year-old sex symbol. And that's great for me. But, you know, I feel like the pop music world is very limiting for any musician. When you broaden it up to the general world, it is very male-dominated. But I feel like there are enough quality female musicians out there, and enough musicians that aren't going to stick you in a box like that. But if you have a little bit of the swimming upstream gumption, then it's not all that bad.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's what you make it. So if you want to persevere, if you want to make something, you do it. You might have some difficulties, some troubles along the way, but, you know, you just keep your head up and you keep doing what you love, and it'll all work out.
Sure. I do think that one thing where my feelings kind of get hurt is when I hear, like, guys being like, oh, yeah, we got together in jam. And I'm like, oh, why didn't you call me? And I know, and then they're like, oh, right, why didn't we call you? It's not because they don't think I can hang. It's because, you know, they're just inviting some of their friends over. And it's like a guy thing, you know. And it's like, I don't think it's conscious on, like, the micro industry level. I think when you start talking to people in LA and stuff, they're very aware of the sexism in the industry. And they know that as a chick, you have to have some degree of sex appeal, that like a guy can get up on stage in jeans and a t-shirt and be fine. But a girl, there's like standards, and people that are actually like deep in the industry will just tell you that, because it's a fact to them. And, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be the rebel that changes all that. I think Alanis Morissette definitely started a long time ago, and I think there's maybe always going to be some room to grow there.
Yeah. Well, what advice would you give to a young girl that wants to make music?
Make music all the time. Make music for yourself because you love it. Share that music with other people because it is your gift to the world. Don't be shy about it. Don't judge yourself. You know, one of the best inspirational quotations that I've adapted is from a dancer named Twyla Tharp, and she said, and I'm going to misquote it, of course, the general saying is, we're artists because we have to make art. You know, it's not our job to judge it. That's what critics do. Our job is just to make it.
That's a good quote. And it goes back to just making music and caring, and not really putting a label on it. It's just making it, putting it out there, and being satisfied by what you did, and you know, fulfilled by what you've accomplished. So I agree.
Yeah. So anytime you get stuck in thinking about it too much, you know, it cuts off the creative juices. There's no way into the creative zone. You know, you really have to just be present in the moment and be satisfied with what you can bring. You know, the more I learn, the more I'm like, oh, the stuff I wrote last year is now good. But that's okay, because I'm writing stuff now that in a year it won't be good, because I'm already like beyond it by my expectations of myself. So I feel like if you live up to your own standards, then, you know, you're pretty good off. I don't know. You're able to be a little more realistic about what you can do.
Well, what are you up to next? What can we expect from you in the, say, next year?
Yeah, I'm super excited. I started working with a songwriter named Ben Shannon. He just won a big folk award out in Colorado and is doing his second and third albums this year. But he and I have been kind of working together on fixing some of my songs up and polishing them a little bit, and I'm getting ready to release my first full-length solo album with a band. And it won't even be Ime and the studio band. It'll be like just Ime, and it'll be with a band. So It's big. It's big for me. I've wanted to do this for a long time, and actually just getting the gumption up to do it and getting all the resources together. You know, being an independent musician is doing 20 people's jobs and getting paid about 20% of what your one person would be worth. So it's and, you know, more swimming upstream. But I think finally putting together this album, and I mean, I'm like just about to get started on the actual recording. We've been recording demos and, you know, kind of woodshedding the songs out a bit. It's awesome, I think, to realize how much support you have when you've been doing something for so long, and people are like, yes, we've been waiting for this moment from you. Like, now, go for it. Make the best album you can, and it's going to knock some socks off people. And I'm like, oh, really? You think so? And they're like, shut up. You don't know that about yourself? I'm like, no, I don't, because I'm invested in the making of it and in the refining. I'm not as invested in my image as I am in the song.
Heavy is the heart that won't quit.
Ime's newest release is Longest Dream. You can hear her music on ericamay.com. That's Erica with a K. Hear more, hashtag WVMusic on A Change of Tune, airing Saturday nights at 10 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And for more West Virginia music chats, make sure to go to wvpublic.org/WVMusic. I'm Joni Deutsch. Thanks for listening.